Welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I am bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, my buddy, my pal, coming back for the big part two, Nicholas Wojciechowski, a.k.a. Nick Woj, a.k.a. Wojavelli, a.k.a. one of the coolest people I know, designer for Concept Skates out of Boston, a real renaissance person when it comes to the discussion of music and culture. We'll get into all this in one second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. This is run by my brother and show producer, and Tristan Abraham, and normally guest booker, but not this week. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do on this show. I really appreciate it. I love you, buddy, so much. Also, if you want to get in touch with me directly, you can find me at various forms of social media at Left4Damien. If you want to support the show, just tell everyone you know about it. Just let everyone know that you listen to this thing. Or you can subscribe to it or rate it on iTunes what else could you do to support? Oh, you can head over to patreon.com/turnoutapunk and check out the fun over there and footnotes and whatnot. Or you can, just listen. Just listen. That supports it too. Speaking of support, this thing would not be possible without the kind, loving support of the fine folks at Vans, who came aboard a couple years ago and said, Damien, do your thing. Just don't lose money doing it. And I gotta thank them for that. Thank you so much to everyone at Vans. There's also a Facebook page that I forgot to mention, and a Tumblr page, and an Instagram page, and all that stuff. So just look up Turned Out a Punk wherever you are. And if we're not there, make your own. No, don't. Well, yeah, do it. Fuck it. Who cares? Make it Turned Out a Punk TikTok. Just make it good. Make it tasteful. Make it good. Okay, on to today's show. Today on the show, we got my buddy Nick Woj here. He's been on before, part one, way back when, one of the earlier episodes. Nick Woj is, of course, from Cold World, an incredible band that I'm a huge fan of. He's also an unbelievable DJ, but also a really, you know, gifted designer. I think that was apparent back in Cold World, even. Like, you look at some of their merch, you know, they were the band that They really revolutionized the merch game in hardcore. But anyway, I'm not going to ramble on because this is a long episode. This is a long ass episode, but it's good. This is for, you know, this is like the hardcore scientist masterclass type thing, the stuff we're getting into and the areas we're going. And there's some debate there. There's some debate between Woj and myself, but I'm not going to ramble on anymore because I do a lot of these things now. So I will be talking to you in a few days. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Nick Woj on Turned Out a Punk. Nick, thank you for coming back on the show.
Yeah, man, it's an honor, bro.
Well, as we were just talking off air, it's been a long time. Like, we haven't talked for, like, you're like one of the first run of people I've had on this thing.
Yeah, dude, I feel shortchanged because I didn't get a footnotes.
You will now. You know, okay. I'll send you your footnotes so you can hear it. But I got an
honorable mention in a footnotes where you had David up and he was like talking shit on having to screen Cold World shirts. But that's about it.
I think your legend has grown large on footnotes, especially too, because Chris O'Toole and I, and you know, like, I think we brought it up there, and so I'll bring it up to you off the bat. Weird way to start it, but okay. It's like, you know, you kind of think about, we've talked about Spaz being almost like the Beastie Boys of hardcore of a different era, and I would say Cold World was, in a lot of ways, you know, kind of like that, you know, obviously scale being different and acknowledging that, but at the same time, like a band that, like, in yourself in particular, bringing all sorts of like cultural influences into a different space, recontextualizing it all and creating something out of it. And then also the wild stories from Cold World tours far exceed any of the wild stories in that Beastie Boys book or documentary.
Well, you know what? I'll concede to the Spaz link, because I'll put it like this, like when, you know, like in the 90s on the East Coast, you know, that scene, the people that were, that like loved that were like to me, like, you know, look, back then I was a fucking dork. I was a geek. I was not cool, you know? So I was, you know, probably a poser and trying to figure out what was cool and whatever. But the people that were like into Spaz and Capitalist Casualties and all those bands, they were like annoying. Like they were the dudes that would like throw the horn, like have the horns up all the time, like during sets and be like, yeah, like they were like always like joking and stuff like that. And, you know, when you're a teenager and you're getting into straight edge hardcore, it's like real serious, you know, how dare they joke around and have fun? You know what I mean? So like as an outsider, I didn't know anything about that music. So I never checked any of those bands out because to me, like, you know, Power Violence or whatever you call it. I know you're not supposed to call it Power Violence or whatever, unless it's those specific bands. But from the East Coast, without knowing the lore, you know, those it's just like annoying, like, you know, funny guy shit. So I kind of see it where like now, like, if someone's into like good hardcore punk and they see like Cold World fans at the time in like the mid 2000s or whenever it was, and they're like these idiots in flat bill hats, you know what I'm saying? Like dress how dudes dress like that. And people were trying to get into like good hardcore. They're like, oh, I'm not, whatever Cold World is, I'm not getting into that because, you know, I don't want to be like those people. So to me, that's the link between Cold World and Spaz. But then like later on, you know, I found out the lore on all those bands and finally checked them out. And I was like, oh my God, like this, there's so much to this scene. And the music is obviously amazing and they did their own thing. And without the stigma of these annoying dudes, you know, piggybacking or whatever, like in the pit, like in the East Coast, without them around to put me off to it, this shit's awesome. And then, you know, hopefully people, I kind of see that happening now where like people, like a lot of people thought Cold World were whack, you know, people with good taste, and then eventually came around. Like I remember before Haroon was in the band, I remember his brother on the Rev Void called this hilarious rap metal. And, you know, later on he became a fan and his brother was in the band and stuff. So I kind of draw a link like that personally.
Yeah. It's kind of funny how differently, Power Violence was taken up on the East Coast versus the West Coast. Like it you know, and in the same way, I would also argue that like, particularly the more Epitaph side of the Epifat stuff, but like that shit in California was very different than it was out here on the East Coast or in Canada, where it was like a lot more little kid music or younger kid music, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, just from hearing a couple guests on your show, like, describe, like, yeah, you go to a Pennywise show and get your ass whooped. I'm like, what?
Yeah, it's amazing how those geographical differences, like, that's the other thing that's really picked up on in doing the show, like, is how those little things make all the difference and, like, how you can't really understand a band unless you grew up in that scene, like, around them.
Yeah, totally.
So I definitely feel with Cold World, I get it. Like I got it. But like right from the beginning with me, I kind of saw, you know, from that, you know, it was like a bunch of people that knew hardcore inside and out and yourself, like, especially like just the way you've kind of gone in your life and the way the path you've kind of gone down, like you've just had that eye for cool stuff in the same way that I would say, like, you know, when you looked at Grand Royal magazine, like you'd flip through mm-hmm. and it wouldn't just be like cool stuff from one space. It would be all different spaces kind of being looked at.
Dude, totally. I mean, just that specific reference. I mean, I remember like looking, having like Grand Royal magazines and it would be like an extensive article on like DJ Magic Mike and like Miami bass music. And then they'd have like, you know, some Bruce Lee stuff or whatever, or something about like vintage Adidas. And then there'd be like a flexi of like Bismarcky covering Elton John. I think that was like one issue. So yeah, like I think that's a good reference point for Cold World, but also like, you know, I think in the last episode, like I went a little too hard on describing like our like older generations in Wilkes-Barre in the scene, like just kind of complaining about how maybe like narcissistic they were in a way, but I kind of take it back, you know, cause they were, I think they were like that too, you know, like they were themselves, you know, and they did their own thing. And we kind of like got all different angles of punk and hardcore from the older generations in Wilkes-Barre. It wasn't so dogmatic, other than some of like the political stuff, which I also think is dope that they were like that. So I kind of like credit Wilkes-Barre, the older Wilkes-Barre dudes to that. Not, you know, they didn't, not directly, but just, you know, just coming up in that scene, you have like a more of an open mind.
It's also funny how heavy, you know, I think we've probably gotten to it a little bit last time, but how heavy like punk rock and hardcore hit in Wilkes-Barre. Like it was such a huge, you know, like it doesn't seem geographically very big, but like the amount of stuff that was going on and the amount of stuff that was happening there, it just feels like it was a lot more than even some bigger cities.
Yeah, I just listened to a podcast with the dude Shane from Title Fight the other day, and the interviewer asked him about that, and he, you know, he went to this, the thing that people always say, that it's like a, you know, it's a stop between New York and Philly, you know, and I think there's definitely something to that. But on the other hand, like, I don't know, dude, like the shows that I was seeing in Wilkes-Barre, it had nothing to do with touring bands, you know. It was really, you know, it was 90s VFW hall basement stuff, you know, like what Mineral were on their huge tour, and they had a, you know, they needed another pit stop. I don't think
we need a routing date.
yeah.
I think also, like, you know, a lot of Wilkes-Barre became, you know, and you guys were, I think, definitely were part of this too, especially in the later part of this, but like became the destination. Like, mm-hmm. No one was going to fests in New York City. And, you know, there were fests in Philadelphia, but like Posse Numbers was the fest.
Yeah, man. That was like, you know, that was a sick time, man. It was like, what was cool about it, it was completely DIY, you know. It was just like a small group of kids doing the whole thing. It wasn't in an arena or a place that – it was in a place that we had normal shows at, you know. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the Wilkes-Barre Fest that was before it. You know, they had it in the fire hall there in Kingston, and it was dope, man.
And once again, to make one of my overreaching analogies, you know, it's amazing to look at, you know, people talk about New York and especially now, like a big deal's made if you look at the early 80s and the late 70s, and you have like the birth of rap music and the birth of punk rock happening kind of simultaneously and the birth of graffiti. It's kind of like in suburban Pennsylvania and into Philadelphia and in parts of New Jersey, you got this whole independent hardcore scene going on. And then you also have simultaneously this whole independent pro wrestling scene also mm-hmm. kind of happening, and both of them become foundational for their separate worlds. But you don't see that happening in other parts of America at the same time. Like you have wrestling stuff, but it's not like the same, and you have hardcore stuff, but it's not really the same.
Yeah. I don't know what it is about that tri-state area or whatever. I think sometimes I hear people say tri-state areas like Connecticut, New York, and New Jersey, and sometimes they say it's New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. I think it depends on where you live. But, yeah, I don't know. It's weird. I mean, I have friends like from L.A. and Cali and stuff, and it's weird when I hear them talk about like what they came up on. They're like, yeah, you know, like stuff that – Not to diss it, but it's like, you know, like their floor punch was like 18 Visions or something, you know? And it's just like a different, I don't know. We were on a different wave.
It was so regional, you know. It comes back to that idea of like this, like sort of regional development. And I guess it's because you didn't necessarily have the outside influences, and you didn't have like now it feels like there's almost like seismic shifts that happen and people start going in one direction or in another direction, whereas you didn't really have the ability to do that.
Yeah. That's true, because I think it wasn't like, you know, when my group of friends, like when we found out about one thing, we didn't say, okay, everything we liked before this sucks. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Which I think is a modern thing, you know? So, you know, it's like when me and Alex got started getting into, you know, more obscure New York hardcore demos or whatever. It's like, we didn't like go out and burn our Texas Is the Reason tape, you know?
You keep coming back to emo.
Dude, that was the thing then. That was the thing there. That was by far the biggest scene, not scene, but I mean, that was something that everybody rocked with there. So I think that had a big influence on us, to be honest.
It's funny too, like you look at the you know, really popular bands that kind of came out of that area as well in the last few years, and it's still emo.
Yeah, man. Title Fight. I mean,
well, and also like even like, you know, like the Goth Boy Click stuff, yeah. And Tiger's Jaw as well, and yeah, it's like a real leaning towards that.
Certain stuff like that, I have a hard time finding the link between like our emo and their emo. I kind of don't buy it. Not Tiger's Jaw, but Goth Boy Click and a lot of that stuff. I think at some point it becomes a stretch to tie them to you know, Firehall emo. I think their emo is like white belt emo. You know what I mean? I think it's, to me, that's different.
I see what you're saying, but I think even like Firehall emo, like, you know, like late 90s Firehall emo was so different from like DC space emo.
I mean, it was in the fact that they were like, you know, making like poppy, like schmaltzy love songs for sure. Like, you know, like Rites of Spring or whatever weren't doing that. But that was definitely their influence. You know what I mean? Where I think that if you were to, you know, to take one of those bands off of the cover of AP magazine or whatever it was, they don't know what any of that is, man. I think they created their own thing. I think linking those two emos is a stretch, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Yeah, I've had a couple people from that kind of world, not maybe that world that we're talking like the AP magazine cover world.
Yeah,
but you know, I've had a few people on that kind of touch that world, and it's amazing how like there are still those links, you know. And it's maybe it's not like Mineral, but it's probably like you know, maybe it's just Brazil, or but it's probably Jimmy Eat World.
Yeah, maybe,
which does connect back.
I think it's all Blink-182, man. I think they're like, yeah, I heard Blink-182, and then I heard Attack or whatever, like that. I think it's like that MySpace stuff. I think that's their DC, you know. I think it's separate.
But then it still connects back, right? Like Blink-182, their record was produced by O, who was in Fluff and Olive Lawn before that. And was that like the early Rock from the Crypt practices and Unbroken shows? So it all connects back.
Yeah, all right. I know that's your job.
That's my job. That's my job, dude. I'm like, you know, my new thing is I don't want to play 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon anymore. now it's 6 Degrees of G.G. Allin.
Okay.
And yeah, everyone connects back. That. You can get people back to G.G. all the time, right? So that's the new game. We're going to trade for
it. I mean, dude, I'm sure G.G. spent some drunken nights in Wilkes-Barre.
Oh, I guarantee it. I would imagine there's no way that didn't happen. Actually, isn't that Youth of the Day photo from... I mean, it's from Philadelphia, the one with all, or maybe it must be Connecticut with all the Youth of Day guys and GG together.
I think it's Connecticut. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm sure there were some Wilkes-Barre parties. Who was like the Wilkes? Were there bands in that era from there? There must have been.
Yeah, dude. There was a big skinhead scene in northeastern Pennsylvania in the 80s. A lot of it's sketchy, obviously.
Yeah.
I don't know about like. I don't know any like bands, any 80s hardcore punk bands from Wilkes-Barre per se. But I think there was, I think Allentown was where everything was going down in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. It's funny then even more that there's this scene that kind of pops up like with like what were the bands that led, like were there bands that before Magnus, like hardcore bands?
Yeah, there was this band called So What. There was this kind of like I don't know how to describe them. They were like kind of like a more traditional punk band called Fabulous Disaster.
Did they put out records on like a bigger label at some point too?
I think there was another band with that name.
Okay, that could be it too.
Yeah. So they were around a long time, and I remember like seeing them a couple times. They were more like, I don't know how to describe them. They weren't like 77 style punk. Like they weren't that cool. They were more like, I don't know. They were like older punk guys that have been around a long time, and I think we're actually trying to like ride the epitaph wave. Mm-hmm. Like, but their, you know, like their logo was like 77 style looking, and yeah, I remember them. There was like before Magnus, dude. There was this awesome band from Wilkes-Barre. They were more like on the metalcore side. They were called Burial Ground. They had a CD and were they had a split 7-inch with a band from Florida. But dude, I would suggest everyone look them up. They had a CD called Let Us Pray, and they, dude, I think they're the best band from Wilkes-Barre.
I just pulled out of my tape collection the Burial Ground Let Us Pray limited edition tape demo that came with a American penny glued to a piece of paper. But I love that fucking demo.
Dude, they're so good.
They're so good. I haven't thought about that, but I always thought they were from Florida.
No, they're from Wilkes-Barre. The singer, Jamie. Yeah, so the thing that I think I texted you, I was like, oh, dude, I have like crazy like Wilkes-Barre like dark lore that I didn't drop on the first one. So like, I guess like a precipice to it is, you know, that dude, Jamie, he was like one of the dudes who would flyer at the mall and stuff. He was like, he was a cool guy in the scene, but he was like super into horror movies and I think like death metal before that was like super normal in hardcore. I remember their drummer was this little Asian dude, and he had like a full on death metal drum kit, you know, the double kick, like, you know, like Neil Peart style. It would take up like half of the room.
Yeah.
But they were from like, I think they had members from like Wilkes-Barre and from Scranton. But anyway, he had a drug problem, and he died, and he was like one of the first dudes from the scene to die. Hmm. But one of my first shows, Dan from Magnus put on, it was like Burial Ground, and it was at this place called Society for the Deaf. I remember they used to always cover We Are 138 and Holiday in Cambodia. I think that they might even cover that on the demo.
They do California Uber Alice on the tape.
Oh, that's what they played. Yep. But dude, that dude's voice was really sick. And yeah. Anyway, a kid from like the first band I was in went on to play in like the last incarnation of that band, this kid, Nate. But yeah, they were sick. There was also this band from Wilkes-Barre called Option. They were like more like, you know, that mid-tempo stompy shit. They predated Magnus. They probably came out like 91.
Okay.
Bedford, they predate Magnus. There was a band, Sunburns Cold. They had a demo. They weren't bad. Trying to think, you know, there's a lot of bands actually.
And so would Magnus play with those bands, or like where would Magnus play?
I wasn't an original member of Magnus, so I saw their first shows, and they were, you know, they were in the mix with the regular Wilkes-Barre scene. So they would play with emo bands and screamo bands, you know, whoever was in town, and a lot of local shows, you know, like they play with Bedford and stuff. But yeah, they definitely played with Burial Ground. I think like the other bands that I mentioned, like Option and stuff, I think they were broken up for the most part by then. Oh, dude, another thing, there was this like 7-inch comp back then. It was called the 7, because back then, right now, Wilkes-Barre area code is 570, but back then it was 717. There was a comp 7-inch called the 717 comp. And it had, you know Jamie Getz, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it had his first band, Outcome. It was them, Brothers Keeper, who, you know, from Erie or something like that.
Lake effect in effect.
Yeah. Something to prove. Shouts to them.
Yeah.
And there was a band called Deckard that were like a Northeastern PA, like they're like kind of heavier emo. And then they turned into, I think they were called Mid Carson July.
Oh yeah. I remember Mid Carson July. Definitely.
Yeah. I kind of fuck with them actually.
Yeah.
They were good. Their drummer was like really good. That was the thing back then, was for all those emo bands to have like crazy drummers. I remember.
Yeah, even Grade. I remember Grade had really good drummers too. Yeah, you're right. It was. I guess you need that. You need someone to hold it down so everyone else can just be flailing around. Yeah.
But yeah, I saw. My friend sent me a flyer the other night. It was like Magnus, You and I, Ink and Dagger, and Our Time, which was like the Roll on the Floor band that I was in towards the end. So yeah, they play with like Kid Dynamite when they first started. You know, it was everybody played with everybody then. You know, it wasn't homogenized or whatever.
Yeah, no, definitely. But when did that, like, I guess we talked about this last time, though, but because there must have been a point where, you know, it started going, right?
I think when it started, when what started going?
Because at one point, like, it was, like, a lot of shows there, not just Posse Numbers, but, like,
yeah,
like, it was the place to go to play shows.
Well, that was all the dude Bob Mack, the dude who put on Posse Numbers, you know, he was always involved in whatever venue was open at the time. I think like the back in the day, like in the 80s and early 90s, the venue in Wilkes-Barre was, I think there was this place called The Factory. Mm-hmm. Like Shelter played there. And I think there's like bands at like a roller skating rink. Like I think like they had crazy shows there. Like I want to say like White Zombie and like Pantera and shit like that played at like the skating rink. I don't know. This like Dan Mills and this dude Chris Thomas, like they were around then, so they would know that stuff. Then there was this cafe called Manus Green, and that was where one of my first shows were. It was just like a little cafe down on the square in Wilkes-Barre, and the people who owned that turned that into Cafe Metropolis, which spanned it was in two different locations eventually, not at the same time, but it so that place had a lot of gigs. And I can't remember if like, yeah, Home Base I think was at the same time as Cafe Metropolis towards the end, but anyway, yeah, Bob and like these other two dudes, they started this place Home Base in this big ass were you ever there?
No, Mike and Josh were, because they got, that's where I think they were both asked to leave Posse Numbers for going on the roof.
Oh, really?
I think, well, no, Home Base was the dome, right?
No. Home Base was like, it was in this big, like industrial, like, I don't know what the hell it was, but you know, there was like offices there and stuff, but I don't know. It was like a big ass room with like a loading dock and stuff. And then the two dudes that I think at first it was these two dudes, Carl G, this dude Vince, and this other guy who was like this crazy like tattoo dude who was into like collecting. I remember like he hearing about him like buying like human skulls and shit like that. He was a weird dude. But the dude Carl G and Vince, they were like ex-hardcore dudes, and like there was a big wave of hardcore dudes that when like Shelter got big, a lot of people like got into the Krishna movement and then somehow like turned into like got super big into the rave scene and became DJs or producers or whatever. And I think these two dudes were in that wave of the scene. Mm-hmm. But they were like really nice guys. And the one dude, Vince, was a tattoo artist, but the dude, Carl G, he was, they were both like techno DJs, but the dude Carl was like a producer. Like he had a room at Home Base that was all like gear, and he would let me go back. Like he knew I was into, you know, like drum and bass and stuff like that and hip hop. So he would let me like fuck with his gear and show me how to do stuff. He was the man, and he actually turned out like super successful. I think he's like Mary J. Blige's like sound man or something crazy like that. Like he made it in music, which is so sick. But and then Bob Mack got involved because he started booking shows there. Those dudes would try to have like raves and stuff, and it would just be like, you know, five people in this giant thing. And then Bob Mack started putting on shows, and they were really big, and he became a partner in it. And I forget why they I don't know, I think their partnership kind of, they lost interest in it maybe, or they moved. And then he moved it to a different location within that complex. Mm-hmm. And he went in on it with these dudes that were into wrestling. I forgot about this. So this is right up your alley. So they would have, the space then, they started calling it the zoo instead of home base. And that was where the Posse Numbers, where Agnostic Front played, was. And I think that was, yeah, that was where the first Posse Numbers Cold World played. So that they had like wrestling there. Dan was a referee at wrestling there. Referee Dan. I'll send you a picture. He had like a promo pick and everything.
Was he actually training at that point?
Nah, I mean, dude, this was like backyard jackasses, but I think some of those dudes took it semi-seriously, but you know, they're like backwoods, you know, Wilkes-Barre people. I don't know.
Some of those dudes are actually probably legit wrestlers now, because it seems like a lot of people that I've talked to got their start after a certain point in the backyard.
I don't think any of these guys were, but who knows? I don't know. I mean, I think they were doing the thumbtack thing and stuff like that. I remember seeing a couple of the shows, and you know, it was what it was. But yeah, so I think once Bob Mack started really, because before him, you know, there was this group of guys. Because you know what, I described the one dude, Ed Gita, to you, and the last one, and it didn't ring a bell. But mm-hmm. if I tell you that he sang for the band An Albatross,
okay, definitely know that band.
So before he was like the dude in that band who would like put his hands down his pants or whatever stuff he's doing now, he was like, you know, like the fucking coolest dude in the scene. So like him and this dude Ted Karpovich, they and probably a couple other guys, you know, I think they're called like Firefly or Mayfly Productions or something like that. They put on the original Wilkes-Barre Fest, and they put on a lot of really good shows back then. So I think Bob Mack kind of like took the torch from them. You know, not like, you know, they didn't like sit down and have a meeting like they would these days, but you know, I think he learned from those guys. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, it was just like that time in the scene where you know, American Nightmare and Right Brigade and No Warning and that whole wave was happening at the same time. And you know, I think Bob was right there. And at the same time, he would book Saves the Day and Piebald and that kind of stuff. So I think that's when it was like going, as you put it.
Yeah, and if you look at those scenes, like, it's, you know, like, obviously very different sonically, but once again, like, a few years earlier, like, they would have been tied together, right? Like, Saves the Day at one point had X members of Mouthpiece in it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and even, like, it was pretty incestuous. I mean, you know, like, what was that band on Rev? Movie something?
Movie Life?
Yeah, like, there was stuff like that, and, like, you know, like, Fast Break, I think we're trying to get into the Saves the Day scene or whatever. So, yeah, it was all kind of tied together at that point, you know. Even Piebald, like, you know, what, 10-Yard Fight's first show was, like, on Piebald's gear or something like that. So I think, yeah, back then that stuff was all tied together.
Yeah, like, it's once again, like, you know, but it's funny when you talk about how, like, rave stuff and of course like wrestling, something that I get obsessed with, but it, like, mm-hmm. it's amazing how it always weirdly connects back to punk rock in some ways, you know, with these
bands. Yeah, well, it's, you know, that's like the origination of like the youth DIY spirit, you know. I mean, no one was doing it. I'm sure some bored dickhead is like, yeah, well, actually in the 60s there was the garage psych scene. Yeah, all right, but I'm sure that was put on by kids, but you know what I mean? Like, it's like, I feel like people like learn how to do things from the punk scene, how to like do it themselves, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Like, you still required, like, even when you look at, you know, there are obviously DIY scenes forever, like you're saying, but like, it's just something like about making music that didn't want any validation, or being making a culture that didn't need or want any validation from the mainstream culture.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
like didn't relate to the mainstream culture in any way. Like, you can really see how that eventually, like, you know, lends itself perfectly to pro wrestling and to, I'm sure to rave music too. Like, you know, like you hear stories about a lot of the early rave people in England being people that came out of punk rock or out of these different scenes, right?
Dude, 100%, especially over there. I think here it's definitely a little different, but not entirely. But there for sure. I mean, you know, I mean, like the acid house and early stuff there, like, comes directly from, you know the post punk scene. You know,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Here, you know, here I think, you know, it came from it was more of a black thing in like Detroit and Chicago and sprouted from there. But I think even then, I'm sure you can find some cool tie in with punk.
Oh yeah. Like, well, we were talking Moby earlier, right? Like,
yeah. Right. Of course. Yeah.
You know, or, and even today, like someone like Bass Nectar being in like a fucking 625 band.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
No, I didn't know that.
I'm trying to remember. I'm trying to remember which one now. Anyway, it's on his cogs. If you look up on the Discogs.
Let's stick to good rave references. Now.
I have no, like, that is my area. That's where I get really exposed at my real lack of knowledge about music outside of records that came out on Epitaph or Fat Records.
I hear you.
But yeah, like I have no idea one way or the other on quality, but like certainly even today, like, you know, someone like Diplo having connections to like the Florida bands and the Florida scene that was happening there. You know, even like Tribe Called Red up here has connections to punk rock and stuff. Like, it feels like it still churns out, you know, and I know you kind of maligned it earlier even, but the Goth Boy Click stuff having connections to punk rock too, right? Like, it's still funny how it keeps churning up stuff. And even Coal World having connections to Ghost Mane.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, in the more modern, connections, I don't know what to attribute that to. Like, I think I said before we started this, I don't buy the complete connection. I don't buy into that as much, but I think the earlier connections, it all goes back to, you know, having to have the place to perform at, you know. And I think they just run into each other from working it out, like the local venue, and working with each other probably on, you know, booking gigs and stuff like that and flyering. So I think that is always just the DIY aspect, you know. I think that's the connection.
Yeah, like, well, you know, it's the on ramp, right? Like, there's yep. no barrier to entry, well, very little barrier to entry. Like, it's amazing. I did a podcast that never came out because the audio was really, really rough on it, unfortunately, with Vagabond and Horror at a festival, like that H09909 group.
Yeah, yeah.
And both of them talked about how that it was that Brooklyn, you know, DIY waterfront scene was like where they got into going to shows and got into music and realized that, like, oh shit, we can do this and
oh yeah,
get on stage and do it. And so it's like, even into the modern era, those spaces are still providing like on ramps for people.
It's interesting though. I mean, like, a lot of the, like I said, like a lot of the current stuff where people get big and then they're like, yeah, you know, it all comes from us growing up going to hardcore punk shows. And it's like, I don't know, man, I would have seen this dude at a show a lot of times.
Yeah, 100% you know? That happens.
So I think people, even just like in my job, man, just because in my job, I work in like streetwear and sneakers. And, you know, the big thing now with these kids is like, yeah, culture, the culture. And when it comes down to it, their culture is like buying a thing, you know? So they have to like find stuff to pretend they were into. So there's all these like new like streetwear brands. It's like influenced from Justin's time of coming up in the New Brunswick punk scene. And I'm like, oh, yeah, huh? You know, so I'll text, you know, Yeeman or Porter. I was like, oh, you know, young Justin, you know, I went to your hood and they don't know you, fam. You know, like Justin is a made up person. Yeah. You know? but there's countless instances of this, you know. So I think it's just like, dude, you can't. I mean, now you can fake it, but you know, when it comes down to it, you were either there at the shows with five people that cost like a can of soup and $2 to get into, like we were talking about before we started, or you weren't, you know.
Well, I think there's levels, right? Like we were in the deepest, dankest pits of what is described as punk rock. Like,
yeah,
you're at the Assuck Reversal of Man tour show, and you paid your $5, and it's like that's where you're at, right? Like, mm-hmm. there are people that were like, you know, it's funny how, you know, this thing keeps attracting people, and, you know, people get into whatever level they're able to get into it, but like it keeps attracting these people that wind up doing interesting things. And like, even if it is something that's not as cool or as down, but like, you know, I don't know, the fact that like the guy from Rockers NYC learned to silkscreen from the dude from America's Hardcore, like that shit is like, I don't know. I think streetwear, once again, like, you know, yourself, like it connects to punk rock in ways, even in the fake ways, it's still connected to punk mm-hmm. rock. Cause like how many fucking first wave punk bands were fake?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I mean, fake what? I mean, if it doesn't exist yet, how are you fake? You know, it's just
okay. You have the podcast I did with Zach Blair and Don Letts.
Yeah. Yeah.
When Zach Blair brings up the Stranglers and Don Letts, it's just, gives them the worst look ever, and mm-hmm. it's like they weren't part of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's how people are with Vice Squad, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they talk about them like that, but it's, I think that's, you know, after you get into the minutia and into the weeds, it's like, I mean, to me, the Stranglers were, they're like, they're just like a rock, dude, they sound more like the Doors than they do the Sex Pistols. So yeah. not to diss them, but you know what I mean? Like, I think like they're one of those bands that get lumped in with punk unwillingly, maybe.
Oh, I've seen very willingly. I think they were.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think they really benefited from that.
No, but what I mean is like, they weren't out there like with like, clothespins through their nose and stuff like that. Like they were like, kind of like the other way of the Jam. Like they were like the punks that like didn't hate Pink Floyd. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I get what you're saying, but like, you know, I think they were probably slightly older too, you know,
yeah.
And looked at this as being, well, like let's lean into this a little bit.
Yeah, probably. I mean, hey man, that's the thing back to dude. Major labels are rocking with you, man. Why not? I'll do it.
Yeah,
no, I'll sell out right now if anybody's listening.
But these things are like, it's all like relative to what you're seeing in your era too, right? Like the way and how deep you were. Like especially doing this show, it's funny. I'll have someone on, and then I'll have someone else on who'll be like, "Yo, off the record, you had that person on. I don't remember seeing them at any of these shows." And I'd be like, "Oh, really? You know, like I'm not, you know, like I had someone accuse." You know, off, you know, someone write me and be like, that guest you had on made up their entire life. I'm convinced they made up their entire life and just trying to be on the podcast. I'm like, I don't think anyone's putting that much effort into getting on this podcast.
But, yeah. Yeah.
But it's still funny how, you know, and how we're still all weirdly protective of this thing.
Definitely. When really there's no reason to be, gives a fuck, but yeah. You know, if I was really put up against the wall and said, do you really give a fuck? No, you know, because it's like, you know, I think about it a lot, man, because like I told you before we started recording, you know, I work from home, so I'm always hearing my thoughts. So to me, man, like the reason you start Fugazi and the reason you start Herman and his Hermits psychologically is probably the same same reason. It's like some Buddy Holly shit. It's like how you want to project yourself to be seen mm-hmm. to other people, you know? So I think it's all the same, man. Like if I'm getting deep.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. Like, I think that's the thing, is we're all driven by some twisted narcissism that makes us want to get up on stage.
Exactly.
And like yep. dance for applause.
Yep. Yep. Especially when you're a teenager, man. I mean, you know yeah. what it's about. You're like, yeah, I just wrote this song. I know I'm, yeah, when I'm playing this song, she's going to be in the audience. That's what it's all about, man.
Yeah. And it's like, then it's about like impressing your peers or fitting in. Like, the reason I wanted to be in a band is because all my friends were in bands. And I'm like, oh God, like, I can't be the only one not in a band. Yeah. Like, I gotta be doing this.
Well, you know what? That's like one differential between hardcore and punk kids that I find is there's ones who like find their identity because they found out what hardcore is, and then they got into music from that. And then there's people who, if hardcore punk didn't exist, they would be into music no matter what.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying. Yeah. So I think there's, you know. It's interesting, man. That's what makes like punk so interesting, is that there's like a, it's like, dude, like now, like another thing, and it's kind of tied to streetwear, is like now, like the big thing is the Grateful Dead, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so you know, you have like, it's just interesting. Everyone trying to like rewrite this, the like what being into the Grateful Dead in high school is, because dude, people that were into Grateful Dead in high school were like boring people that were just into their like parents' music. They didn't like music, and like once a year they would go to see Fish or whatever and smoke a joint, and that made them interesting, and that was it. That's literally, there's like now, and now they're trying to like I had this argument with my friend Nick, and I was like, dude, like I'm sorry, but like that's not a culture, like, you know what I mean? Like, those to me, it's not like, yeah, there's a culture of like selling drugs in the parking lot, and like, so if that's the culture, then it's bad. It's like, it's just like dark. There's no positivity to the culture. What, everyone just goes to see these old dudes, and the culture is they just like destroy themselves to this. It's crazy, man. Come on.
See, I can come at it. I can see both sides definitely on this argument, because I agree with you, the music is 99% completely unlistenable.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing that for me, like, I actually don't mind that first record. That's a decent record. There's some really good songs on it. But
Box of Rain.
Yeah. But like, when it's like a 2-hour jam and it's just like all these, like, I don't get it. But at the same time, like, I also see how, you know, there's all the connection to like the Hell's Angels. There's all right. like, the,
it's, here's the thing,
it's all interesting.
I'm not even dissing the music, and I'm not dissing the band and the original. I'm talking about in the 90s early 2000s,
brutal,
where it's like the kid, like if you're in high school, in high school and that is what you're into, yo, you're a dork, you know? Yeah. Like I remember like, so I listened to Stern 3 days a week, you know, every day he's on, I listen to it, because when a job that I used to have was delivering chips for Frito-Lay Incorporated. And so I would have time to like listen to Stern and podcasts and stuff. And, you know, all the early podcasts were like comedians, you know?
Yeah.
So I'd be like, oh yeah, this is a comedian. I wonder what he's talking about. I wonder, you know, so many times they're like, yeah, you know, in high school, I was just like really into like Grateful Dead and stuff. I'm like, what the fuck? All these comedians were dorks in high school. So to me, it's like, I don't know, man. It's those were like people that had no personality in high school.
I don't know. There's that infamous Vivian Girls quote where they, you know, which they got jumped on, I think, completely unnecessarily for, but about the fact that, you know, normals and not relating to normals. Mm-hmm. And like, I think back to high school, and like, I had friends that weren't into punk rock, definitely. But like,
yeah,
the vast majority of my friends, like, if you weren't questioning the shit around you and you weren't into something cool, be it rap or punk, like, you probably were like a I want to say dork, because that implies that I'm saying I was cool. Wasn't cool.
Right. That's the thing. That's why I wanted to preface whatever story I told earlier, where I was like, I was a dork. I was not cool. Like,
yeah.
It's not that you're better than these people, but you know what it is? It's like when you go to – when you see like a kid in high school and you're like, this person is already – I already know his adult form.
Yeah.
That is what a normal is. You know what I'm saying? And also like, yeah, like a band in this day and age will get like – you get ridiculed or roasted for saying normie or whatever now, because you can't say anything. Like you have to think of the post reactionist. You know what I mean? Like obviously, if somebody says anything like racist or sexist or homophobic, like that's whack. But now we're to the point where we can't even differentiate ourselves from normies. Like, come on, like. In high school, when you'd go to your friend's house, you never at his house before, and you go into his bedroom and you see his like Iowa stereo. You know, everybody had those like fucking lame ass five CD changers, and you saw a stack of Hootie and the Blowfish, Pearl Jam, and fucking Crash Test Dummies, and that was his CD. That's a normie. You know what I'm saying? Like, that is a normie.
You know, it's funny you picked those three bands, because I can also connect all three of those bands back to punk rock, but I won't subject you to that now because I agree with you on the thesis.
Yeah, I mean, of course, I mean, you can connect them, but but yeah, I mean, that's a normie, you know, that's
100%. And it's like, why would you, like, not like, why would you be into what you're into? Like, you're into what you're into, but at the same time, like, I just couldn't be into that stuff.
Yeah, I don't know what it was. I mean, for me, it was probably I don't know if I was insecure or whatever. Like I wasn't, you know, I wasn't cool. I wasn't good looking. I needed maybe deep down I needed an angle. You know what I mean? Like I was like a coworker. I sent her like the picture of these new Tyler the Creator shoes that came out. I was like, tell me these aren't straight out of a 1997 Delia's catalog. And I know that because I was, you know, in 1997, I would look at the Delia's catalog and be like, oh yeah, these chicks would get me. You know what I mean? Not the chicks in high school with the Grateful Dead shirts and the Birkenstocks or whatever that they were wearing then, you know, these Delia's chicks with the big ass chunky sneakers, they would think I'm cool.
But it's like it's amazing how, like, you know, you feel this call, I feel this call, like Lita Amy from the WWE feels this call, like Steve Aoki's feeling this call out in California. Yeah. Like it just draws all these wild, interesting people. And it's also like we're talking about, like, obviously I have a very broad definition, as people that listen to this podcast know, of punk rock and people that, you know, and I think people can claim it, but like if we're talking about like DIY basement, you know, Can of Soup and $5 type hardcore shows, or $2 in the Can of Soup type hardcore shows, you know, it's amazing how many people crawled out of those basements and are doing stuff that's like crazy interesting or fascinating.
Well, you know what else is amazing is the amount of people that were hardline, straight edge psycho warriors that are now, you know, posting their dog on Instagram 5 times a day and are just like complete. They're normies now. It's like it's weird, man. I mean, it's just part of growing up, you know.
Like do you ever think that, you know, when you look at Fall Out Boy, that like that hardline scene begets Fall Out Boy years later, in a way.
Yeah.
So it's like even that hardline stuff produces, you know, dog Instagram posters and pop stars.
Yeah, I think hardline was probably just a regional thing, though, right? Like at that area, that's what straight edge was.
Well,
you know? It
popped up in like I'm like hardline. This is one of the areas I'm like obsessed with and fascinated.
I don't know too much about it, to be honest.
So there are only three hardline bands ever, right? There was Vegan Reich, Raid, and Statement from England. And Statement's just one dude. It's like a one-man band. And the guy from Statement disavowed Hardline real early on because he definitely didn't agree with some of the less than appealing side of the politics. And he was like, and he's still going, apparently. I don't know if he's still going to this day, but in the early 2000s, he was still putting out records.
Oh, wow.
And he's like a real anarcho kind of like peace punky type guy.
Okay.
But then, and then there was the Raid stuff, which now is Beget Lucero. And then the stuff on the West Coast, that was like Vegan Reich and that. And I've never seen any live footage of Vegan Reich. At all. Like it's I've been looking for a while now, and I can only really find like one or two flyers and no live photos at all. But and of course, you know, Raid, there's a bunch of stuff online.
That yeah. Vegan Reich are interesting because they, from what I remember, I mean, dude, I never listened to fucking hardcore, let alone this, like, you know what I mean? Like on the daily. So it's been years, but
yeah.
Aren't Vegan Reich like, like they have fast songs and shit, yep. right? Like, yep. like they have like outburst parts and stuff. Like they weren't straight chugga, chugga, chugga like you would think they were.
And same with Raid too, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I remember talking like Scott Bibin from Bloodlink Records.
Yeah.
Was part of it too. He was like he identified as Hardline and was part of the movement and like.
Oh really?
He got kicked out of Hardline. I remember him telling me this when I was like a little kid. So maybe he was just fucking with me, and I've just bought it for all these years.
Is he? Is he still a person? Is he still around?
I think so. Like it was you know, mind you, it's like 10 years ago now. But like I think yeah. so. I should look him up because he'd be.
Dude, I'll tell you what, that would be a great interview.
It'd be a real interesting one. Definitely the Springer stuff.
Yeah, I mean, look, that dude doesn't know who I am, but when I first, the first couple of years of being in Philly, like I ran into him with other people a couple of times, and he's an interesting dude, and you know, he comes from that era in the mid '90s where in early '90s where it was like, you know, like those dude. This is another thing that I bring up if I'm getting into a talk about hardcore. It's like. Who is the modern kid who's throwing yogurt at Earth Crisis? Like where's the, you know what I'm saying? Like who's taking the piss? Like I don't see any interesting or funny or like, you know what I'm saying? Like where's the rabble rousers?
Yeah, I think also the thing is like shit gets bigger now. Right, really quickly. Like the stuff that's actually going to get big gets bigger really quick. So you don't really have that the same sort of like big egos, cast of characters, kind of like living in the scene that's only really like 1,000 people when you get down to it. You yeah, know?
And I second guess it because it's just like okay, like look, man, I know who starts hardcore bands. 90% of these kids went to college. They're smart individuals, and. They're only interested in making people fake kick and punch one another for 20 minutes. Like that's what they're there for. Like no one wants to, you know what I'm saying? I don't know. It's crazy to me. That's like the whole like cerebral aspect is gone. In my opinion.
I think also, yeah, you had like some real genuine kind of like weird people involved in it. And like, yeah. I think even if you look back earlier on, you had some really, you know, like, and out of that, you know, there's genius, but out of that, there's also like just straight up weirdness. But, you know, like you go back to the beginning, you see that too. Like it's once again, I think it's just such a magnet for interesting personalities. And like, I think now it's harder to be into shit, right? Like I worked at a cannabis marketing company last year for a while. And I would go in there and I'd be like, talking to people and I'd be like, oh, what are you into? And everyone's like, I play video games. I play like, you know, this video game on, you know, and,
yeah, yeah.
Or it's like, oh, I like Drake. And it's like, oh, what else? It's like, you know, like some random song that's on the radio. It really feels like you don't need to cling to culture for identity as much as we did.
Well, it's crazy because the person said that probably with like dyed purple hair, gauged ears. You know what I'm saying? Like that person looked 10 times crazier than anyone at a fucking Hardline show, probably.
yeah.
No, you know, it's weird, man.
It's weird. Well, it's just like it's different, right? Like it's such like I think about movies. Do you remember movies in the 90s? How it was like, you
dude,
know,
I bring this up all the time. Yep.
It's different, right? Like, and now it's like there's no such thing. Like, obviously, there is these things, but well,
now it's TV. Because I always say, like, where to me, it's just like the streamlining of everything and the streaming and like all that. I think it's just killed culture as a whole, because I don't even mean indie culture or underground culture, but even just it's like with movies, it's like I'm not a big movie person. I don't know anything about movies. I hyper focused on music from an early age, so I missed movies, but I do know that it's like, where is like the Silence of the Lambs of today? Where's like the single white female, like the blockbuster movies that everybody saw, but they weren't Spider-Man. You know what I mean? Like what the fuck? But I guess it's Netflix. It's TV now. It's not movies. So there's always an answer to everything where we're like, dude, everything sucks now. You know, there's always an answer that makes you look like a dumbass. But in reality, it's like, I don't know, man.
Well, we've moved to like such a intense monoculture.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
like the idea of like saying you don't, and maybe it's because everything has to happen in public now, but like the idea of going online and saying you just don't like this artist, like, holy shit, will you, you know, you'll get like a raft of fans coming at you.
Dude.
And it's just like, it's different now. Like,
well, that trickles down to punk. I mean, it's definitely not cool to say that a band sucks on Twitter. You never see that.
In hardcore now, you're right. You don't
see that. You don't see that. It's not cool. But when I was first, you know, message boards, hardcore punk message boards back then, I mean, dude, if Cold World never played a show, I would think that we didn't have any fans.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, or fans or people that liked us. You know, but even before that, you know, like I remember like local message boards, like I remember like I got like really into Strife, and I remember like everybody, all the older dudes on whatever message board it was, they said that they were just a Judge ripoff and they sucked. You know what I mean? So like, yep. You know, you don't see that now. People like totally roasting bands or bands getting called out for sucking, you know.
It was almost like as soon as a band got popular in hardcore, everyone had to like, it was like the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it would just be like, well, the page has turned on that band. Let's get out the knives.
Yeah.
And it's different. It's very different now. It's like a lot more, and it's probably better, to be honest with you, because it's a lot more positive.
Right. Well, like I said, like you could have your, you know, your view on it, but then someone can explain to you how it's better this way. And I get that, but for some reason I just think like I was better off being a teenager, you know, or whatever in like 1992 or 1993, and I was able to, you know, I don't know, just the amount of cool shit that even like you just like, I don't know if you like I was super into comic books then, you know, like it all like there was like cool like underground comics and mm-hmm. shit, like mm-hmm. I don't know, it just seemed like there was so much more subversity and it also seems like it was like more intelligent, you know, you'd be faced with more like intelligent outlooks, you know, where like a kid now, like a teenager, you know, they get into like Fortnite or whatever the fuck, like what's that gonna do to them? Is that gonna, you know what, like memes are really going to like make someone intelligent, like the way, you know what I'm saying? The way that like reading like interesting zines were back in the day or something. I don't know. Like I said, someone always has a reason to where, yeah, of course it's better now. So I'm probably wrong, but from my experience, I don't see it.
Well, you know, and I've talked about this with different people. You know, I don't think I ever talked about it on the show though, but like, I think that the generation that we were from in punk and hardcore was like a very, it was like such an interesting time. It was kind of like you still, because you had grown up having to pay for information, mm-hmm. You still valued information in a really very intense way. But then all of a sudden it was all free. And so, or it wasn't, but it was all accessible, you know? And so you could go to all sorts of places. I don't mean before the internet kind of blew up, like I sound like I'm 1,000 years old, but, but like before the internet became like part of our daily lives, even like distribution was different. Like this stuff post Nirvana was popping up in mainstream places post, you know, like there were like great mainstream rap records coming out of the 90s. There's great mm-hmm. films that were getting distributed properly and you'd hear about them. And there was like an independent press that would be there to bolster this stuff up. And it felt like, yeah, like it was just like, we were a very, lucky generation to have this kind of like, awareness and understanding of the value of this stuff. And then suddenly to have all the access to it.
Yeah, well, then when you quote unquote have all the access, not to get on some conspiracy theorist shit, because I'm not that at all. I hate that. But you know, then you're the young consumer is at the will of the host. You know, when you walk into the record store, or the comic shop, you know, you see whatever you know current incarnation of X-Men or Superman is there, but then next to it there's, you know, just a couple rows down there's 8-Ball or Hate or, you know, or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. Same with a record store, whereas now, you know, you go on iTunes or Spotify and you go to the new releases or whatever, it's what they tell you is there, you know.
Yeah,
I don't, it dumbs you down, man.
Well, it's yeah, because now like you have everything at your fingertips, and constantly, and it's just like I go through it like when I'm like, what the fuck am I going to listen to? Like I got everything to listen to.
You have everything at your fingertips, but it's still like you still have to have the you still have to be the person who wants to find something different. You know, that's how I see it. Like it's just like when you know in my job, like with the kids that I work with, you know. You would think I'd be finding out about the new rappers from them, but I'm not. And it bums me out. Yeah. You know what I mean? I'm like, what? You guys still don't know about Chef G? You don't know, you know, you don't know, you know, whatever. You don't know UK Drill yet. They're still on Travis Scott. Cause they only want one. They only want
Travis. They got Travis Scott. It's a good Travis Scott. Why would I need to look anywhere else? So the same with like Drake or, you know, or same with it, even like on like rock music stuff, like people get their one band and they're like, why would I need anything else? I got this like,
well, it's because they're a normie. They're the kid with the Hootie and the Blowfish and Pearl Jam CD next to their Iowa.
Yeah. No, we're in a generation where it was conceivable that you could be completely untouched by a corporation. You could just be like this like independent musician putting out your independent records, like touring independently, dumpster diving for your donuts and just like, you know, your records are distributed by Ebullition, you know, they were sold at DIY stores without a barcode.
Yeah.
But that doesn't exist. That will never exist again.
I mean, dude, think about that whole scene where it's like, it only exists as like 7-inch rips.
Yeah.
On YouTube and blog spots, you know what I mean? Like, is the like Lincoln and Hoover split on iTunes? I don't fucking know. Is the Portraits of Past discography on Spotify? Who the fuck knows?
But and what doesn't Portraits of the Past have connection to Tim and Eric too?
Yeah, I think the dude that played in Ink and Dagger might have been
Eric,
in that band.
Yeah, Eric was in that band too. So there you go. Yeah. We need like a full like numero group reissue of just the Philadelphia 7-inch in brown paper envelope sleeves.
Well, dude, this is here. It also makes me think of like, you know, when things get deemed, you know, good or bad or in the canon or not in the canon of the history of punk, that era of stuff, you know, isn't deemed good for some reason. You know, when they write the history book, that's just going to be a blip in it, you know, like that whole scene. It's like it may have never existed for some reason. Like it doesn't get. Do you know what I'm saying?
No,
like,
the early '90s are like a time that you know Chris and I on Footnotes have become kind of obsessed with because it's the idea that like it's like the dark time, like before Green Day really hits and everything gets picked up again. Where it's just kind of this valley of stuff kind of happening, like 7-inches and Festcore. It's like,
yeah.
But then you think about like all the shit, like that's Steve Aoki wilding out on the floor at the Pickle Patch, or mm-hmm. like, you know, like Tim or Eric from Tim and Eric, you know, playing in Frail, or not Frail, like Porch of the Past, but yeah. like, you know, like all these
get bands. It right, man.
Sorry. you know, even Jack Johnson was involved in like the California kind of emo scene.
Oh yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's unending.
I mean that when it comes down to it, that scene was, you know, it was earnest, you know.
It was definitely earnest.
You know, these dudes had their 7 inches. The covers were like threaded together with like yarn
yeah.
and shit. You know, that it was cool. Is it listenable to the average hardcore kid's ear now? Probably not. You know,
I bet you that stuff comes back in a big way in the next couple of years. I'm thinking.
I hope so, man. Because like I said, man, like I know the demographic of the kids in these bands that are pretending to be idiots. They're pretending to be street dudes. They're pretending to be altercation. They're not, you know, like it's like this band, they're not dissing them because I think they're good at what they do, but this band, do you know this band Three Knee Deep?
I don't think I do know that band.
Okay, so they're a new band from Florida, and they're like heavy ass beatdown shit. Like they study like Second to None and Back to Basics shit. You know, yeah, like I could tell what they, you know, and they make a lot of rap references. But the reason I like them is because the rap references they make, they're not like making like lame like Gangstar references. Like they're making like regional rap references. Like they reference like Tony Draper, like the dude who owned Suave House Records back in the day, like stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the kind of hardcore I listen to, but they are like writing, you know, they think twice about the riff they write, which I think is rare now. But anyway, like, you know, all the songs are like, you know, it's like Fury of Five shit, you know, dude, the singer is like a chemist.
And like it was like that with Fury of Five too, I think.
No, dude. Yeah. But yeah, it's funny. It's like it's like, yo, you guys have more of an education than you know, probably any Discord band, but you're pretending to be beating dudes down. Like it's like, doesn't that, and they do it well, and it's cool. I'm not dissing them. So I'm just using them as an example, but it's like, how long can it go where everyone is just kind of cosplaying? And I know that, like, you know, a lot of people could point the finger at Cold World as like as helping start it. And I kind of like trait, if you want to like talk like inside baseball, me and like George from Blacklist, we talk about it a lot. Like we, you know, like in the, like, it seems like there's definitely like a crossover point where, like, you know, like at first, like dudes that were into Youth Crew stuff or whatever, they didn't always like Madball. Mm-hmm. You know, they mm-hmm. didn't like that stuff. They didn't like anything except for that. And like, you know, and vice versa. And then I think, you know, like No Warning and Right Brigade. And once Death Threat started playing with us, yeah. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. That's when the crossover, and then there was no turning back, you know? And you know, I think the music got better because of it, as far as like that hard, you know, hard ass hardcore. But I think you lost that regionality where, like, if you were to mix, where if you were to like associate it with like rap, like, you know, there was a point when rap was regional. Every different area of the country sounded completely different. And then there was a flip of the switch and it all sounded the same. You know, I think that happened in hardcore.
Well, now that we're getting super inside baseball, it's funny that both artists that do that are from Toronto, right? Like, people accuse Drake of being the flip switcher in rap music, where all of a sudden it became like, you know, not regional, it became like the sort of pan regional kind of style. And, you know, No Warning too. Like, you know, all of a sudden New York hardcore wasn't in New York. It was being done in Toronto.
Yeah. I don't know. That's a good point. I think the earliest seed of it that I can remember was finding out that In My Eyes dudes sang backups on
a Madball 7-inch. Mm-hmm. Or I forget what it was, but it was like, it was something like that. And I was like, what? That's fucking crazy. You know what I mean? And then it kind of spitballed from there. And I think maybe, you know, it might have started in Boston, really, you know.
I think it started in Boston, like that side of it, but I still think it's like more connected. Like Sweet Pete to the Madball dudes is somehow mm-hmm. more connected than Toronto too.
You're right. Because No Warning was more of like a case study.
Yeah. And No Warning. Yeah. 100%. Those guys, you know, and I say the same thing about Drake, you know, and this is not an insult to, cause I love No Warning and I also have unbelievable amounts of respect for Drake, but both of them, like what they did was like analyze this music. And it's like a very postmodern approach to it. Like, oh shit, Maximum Penalty totally. Demo and like Outburst 7-inch. And like,
Drake, on that last album, Scorpion, there was like samples where it was like the hook to the one song is like a sample of this Memphis dude, MC Mac, which is so fucking Blogspot, Reddit style regional rap. Like he's, you know, it's crazy. So yeah, it is a case study like that, you know, where Drake's like, okay, we'll add a little bit of Houston, a little bit of rapping forte, a little bit of this and that, you know. So, and it's dope on a music aspect, just like No Warning were, you know, because it comes out, it's like, oh, they did this perfectly. Like they, you know, they know about breakdown, you know, whereas a youth crew, straight edge kids in sometimes in New Jersey didn't know about breakdown at the time. You know what I'm saying? So yeah, it's good for the music. And at the time it was genius, but it led us down a dark path possibly.
It's funny. Cause like hardcore and hip hop start in New York at the same time, right? Like same moment in history. Like, you know, like they kind of really get going. And then they both kind of meet this sort of like weird crossroads in Toronto, which is New York with training wheels, as we're called. You know,
New York with training wheels.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. I find it interesting. And like, once again, I'm like a fan musically and I can kind of, you know, I don't think it's as dire as you're describing what happened, but I think,
yeah, no.
But you definitely can see it. You're right. Like, and like also Right Brigade.
Put me up against the wall and ask me if I really give a fuck or if it means anything. No, it doesn't. Like I said, this is just us getting inside baseball if we're really going to have to dissect it. Yeah. In reality, who gives a shit?
Yeah. But also it's funny you brought up Right Brigade, that Right Brigade demo, that changed Toronto, or like the No Warning part of Toronto hardcore in a huge way. Like when they heard that demo, that's when they changed their sound.
Yeah, you know what? I think it was like might have been like Blood for Blood's influence on the Boston youth crew dudes, and then going from there. You know,
that's interesting. I never thought about the Blood for Blood influence on the Boston stuff, but yeah, 100% that would make sense too.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, those bands those dudes were dealing with hard asses up there probably before anybody, you know, because in, you know, when things were more separated, it definitely like in Wilkes-Barre, it's like, you know, there's two different scenes basically, you know, mm-hmm. if you wanted to see Warzone or Strife or any kind or Crutch or any of those bands, you had to go to CC's, and then all the other stuff was at, VFW halls and shit like that.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's interesting to like look at that. It's funny because also like Blood for Blood would play Toronto a lot before they kind of got popular in kind of like other parts of the hardcore scene. So when they were still kind of playing in the more kind of like, you know, they would play here with like Stigmata and stuff, mm-hmm, and there'd be like 12 people at these shows. Like I would be there and then there'd be all these like real tough guy types. And my little brother would be there and some, maybe a couple other kids that would wind up becoming like, you know, part of the scene. But it was like, it was not connected to like you're describing, like the quote unquote hardcore scene in Toronto. Like that was a very separate kind of scene from this scene.
Yeah. I mean, there, you know, like anything, you know, it's obviously still hardcore. And then, you know, like I remember like those two bands specifically play like Dan Mills from Cold World and Magus. Like he put on a show that it was Blood for Blood, Stigmata, and it was in Nanny Coke at this place. I don't know what the, I don't even know what this place was. It was just like a community center.
Yeah.
It was actually where the very first Posse Numbers was. But I remember it was like early Blood for Blood where they had like a woman guitar player. Like I think their second guitar player was a woman at the time.
Yes, you a bass player.
Okay, bass player.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that was a sick show.
Yeah, they were that I love that band. Like I think I got hip to them because the Victory catalog had talked about them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, I got to check this band out. And then they were coming to Toronto. They played here. They like, I don't know why they kept coming back. Like they came like three times to no more than 14 people. One time them and Stigmata and maybe a third band played at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Thursday. And then they had to clear them all out because the Promise Ring and Grade show was happening at the venue that night.
Oh shit.
It was brutal.
See, I would rather see Promise Ring than any of those bands at that time.
I was at both shows. Like, you know, you're like yourself. I was one of the people that liked, you know, yeah. all of it. So yeah. I went to both shows and both were sick.
You know? Yeah, of course, man. Of course. Everything was sick then. I mean, it was not in retrospect. Like I said, that's the thing. Like the people writing the book of the canon of what was good and what's not, you know. You know, a lot of the shit that I think was so good isn't, you know, doesn't make the cut or whatever. I don't care.
Yeah, like there's definitely bands that I think are just like completely written out of modern hardcore history. Like they just didn't even happen. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to see like, oh yeah, like but that shit was huge, you know, like like
yeah, know. Like do people? I mean, especially like I remember like the big thing. At like the last, maybe the last like Wilkes-Barre Fest before Posse Numbers, was Romulans.
Yeah, the Romulan haircut.
Yeah, you know, and I was like, dude, what is this? You know, like I didn't, you know, like do people know about Romulans now? I don't know.
Well, yeah, do people appreciate how influential the Locust were outside of music, like just like fashion wise on. On the scene at that point, like it was like the Romulan thing that comes from San Diego.
Yeah. Yeah. That, well, I mean, that's like what Justin Pearson shit or whatever.
Yeah. Right? Like it's like, it was a zeitgeist, you know, yeah. It was, or even like a band like Shutdown, you know, like that band was huge. And like, I've never heard anyone talk about them since.
I mean, I'm sorry if anyone's listening from Shutdown, but I mean, it's because they're unlistenable. But
they had a good judge song. They had Craig Sitari doing vocals on the one song. They were and they're back to basics too.
Yeah, dude. You know what? There's this one band that had a split on Back to Basics with Mushmouth, who are a really heavy ass PA hardcore band. But they were from the Scranton area.
Mm-hmm.
They were called Livin' Proof. And that's a band from PA that I feel like needs to be talked about, but I would like much like Burial Ground, I'd like to mention because they were interesting, dude. I remember like posting on the Herps board. I posted the demo one time, and these dudes, like I remember the singer and the bass player, their names were Pepe and Eduardo, and they would be full out hip hop gear. Like they wore like batter's gloves when they were playing. They looked so sick. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. And actually, the bass player for Magnus, Jesse, was in Livin' Proof early on before I knew him. And I think he might've wrote a lot of the songs in the demo, but anyway, dude, they were so hard. And I remember I posted the demo on Herps and dudes were like, yo, this actually sounds like Hellhammer somehow.
I got to hear that demo.
Yo, it's so fucking good, man. But
the
yeah,
seven-inch good? The split?
Yeah, dude. Yeah, both sides are good. Mushmouth back then, they were like real heavy.
Yeah.
But Livin' Proof were like, they were doing like the rapcore, but it wasn't super rapcore. Because like I said, like I think like them sounding like Hellhammer is on accident because they weren't they weren't the greatest musicians.
Yeah.
But they were awesome, man. So that was like probably a early influence on me. As far as like incorporating like hip hop style into hardcore, like, you know, for sure. But yo, the lore that I wanted to drop on you that I was meant now that I mentioned the dude Jesse from Magnus. So the crazy thing about shit that I didn't tell you about Magnus, half of the members of Magnus now are dead.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So that dude, Jesse, he was the bass player. He moved to Cali or Vegas or something and moved around a little bit. And he got really into being a tattoo artist. And he actually gave Britney Spears her first tattoo, right? And remember those shows on MTV where it would be like the lifestyle of Britney Spears and it would just like go or whatever, celebrities, and it would like say, oh, Britney just got her first tattoo. And it showed a picture of Jesse tattooing her, and then it showed a close-up of the tattoo, but it showed a different tattoo. So Jesse sued MTV, of course, for misrepresenting his awesome tattoo skills, which was like, you know, like a 2x2 like butterfly or something at the time. But he was awesome, man. He was just like a naturally cool dude, but he got like, you know, he got mixed up with drugs pretty bad, and he became best friends with Jay from Jay and Silent Bob.
In real life?
Like that, real life. And so, you know, unfortunately, you know, if you know the lore of him, like what comes along with that is, yeah, they were drug buddies, and he, I think, I don't know if like he died like when they were together, but like him like dying of an overdose is, I heard, is like what set the dude Jay like over the edge to like get clean.
That's wild.
Yeah, yeah. Like I remember when he first like moved to Cali, like we spoke sometimes. He'd be like, yeah, like I hang out with the dude Jason Mewes. He's like, I'm homies with like dudes that are in Far Side too, and a couple other bands, I forget. But yeah, so that's how he died. Then the original drummer was this dude Hans, and he died like well after Magnus was a band. He died like when I think Cold World was already a band. So him dying wasn't what brought me in. But he was like a cool dude in the scene. He was like really good at graffiti and stuff. And he was still around in Wilkes-Barre, but wasn't active in hardcore. He'd come around sometimes. But he was like really big into being good at playing drums, which I am not. But he came to this show. It was like Bane and whatever Bill Stevenson's band was at the time.
Only Crime?
Maybe. I don't know.
I think Only Crime, probably.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know. Probably, because I never heard of them. So I was at the show just like hanging out outside, and somebody came out. I was like, yo, Hans, like, passed out or something. I'm like, what? And they bring him out on a stretch, like an ambulance comes and they bring him out on the stretcher and like put him in the ambulance. And I remember like me and this dude not goofing on him, but just being like, oh, this dude like hasn't been to a show in years, and he comes back and it's all about him, like making like some like super lame joke that's just so stupid. But it turned out he had like some kind of heart problem he didn't know, and just had like some like a heart attack or something and died at that show.
Wow.
Yeah. And then the original guitar player,
you know, I was going to say, you know, that guy Zach Blair we were talking about earlier from, mm-hmm, it was in the MVP episode where they saved the Macho Man from the Misfits.
Yeah.
He was at that. He played in that band. So he must have been at that show too.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, that's fucking crazy. But yeah, apparently I'm not a Baniac, but apparently Bane have a song about that, about a dude like dying at their show that's about Hans.
Wow. That's so, I got to ask Zach Blair about that too, because he would have been there too.
Yeah. So there's some dark lore. And then there's this other dude, Hugh, who played guitar originally, who I used to say was dead. But he's not dead now, because he dropped off the face of the earth. He was older than me. I didn't know him, and he like didn't have a presence. But then, like, I guess he started posting on Facebook and ruined my whole theory on him being dead.
Well, dude, we have talked. This has got to be one of the record breaking shows for the last little run of shows. Anytime you want to come on, you know the door is always open to you, Woj.
Yeah, man, I can't wait to hear the footnote on this one.
You got to come on the footnote for this one. We got to do a dissection.
Oh, yo, I'm down, man. I'm down.
Thank you for coming on the show, Woj. And you heard right there, Nick will be back for a part 3 at some point down the line, because he and I have been texting ever since. There's a lot of stuff we didn't even get to.
And yeah, maybe he's going to come back for a footnotes. You know, maybe we got to do some sort of, you know, next time we do a super show, I'm definitely going to invite Nick onto the super show. So there you go. Also, Nick DJs under the name Wojavelli, and you can find his stuff at soundcloud.com/Wojavelli. And yeah, check out some of the stuff he does. A brilliant, you know, producer, musician. He wears a lot of hats, this dude. Oh, I love that episode. I love that episode so much. Okay, speaking of loving episodes, you're going to love the next episode, because next episode of this show that is going to be dropping in a few days, we have the fucking legend. There's no other way to put it with this guy. From the band Bad Religion, from the brand new band Fake Names, but also of the band Minor Threat, of Dag Nasty, of Junkyard, of Sam Hain. We get into all this stuff next week on the show. It is a doozy. It is a doozy and a half. So please tune in next episode for Brian Baker. And that's it. Okay. You know, I'm going to leave you with that. Go out there and make your own culture. Fuck police brutality. Fuck racist cops. Fuck all that shit. You know, fuck fascism. 100% fuck fascism. You know, sign your organ donor cards, create your own culture. But definitely fuck fascism. That's 100% in mind right now. And I'll see you next week on the show, or next episode on the show. Thanks for listening. Love you. Stay safe.